This Sunday, the University Symphony Orchestra will take the stage under the direction of longtime music director Bruce Uchimura, who's my guest here in the studio today this morning to talk about the program. Welcome once again.
Good morning.
Tell me how the first concert of the season came off with the Stolberg Bronze Medalists.
Stellarly.
Glad to hear it.
It was very good. The orchestra, you know, I think the first concert of the year is one of the better ones, because all the kids are fresh from summer vacations and they're ready to rehearse big repertoire, and that's the way I plan it. Now, the last concert of the year, maybe not, but they also rise to the occasion and have a lot more experience by then. So
absolutely.
It was a young, as I told you before, it was a young, rather young orchestra this year, but they rose to the occasion, and I think they did really marvelously on that big Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony, Dvorak Carnival Overture, and the Prokofiev Second Violin Concerto with the soloist.
Mm-hmm. Well, this week on Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium, you've chosen a program that will bring a lot of light into our hearts. It's a beautiful program of pieces that are a joy to listen to by Ravel and Beethoven. Great
mm-hmm.
contrast, actually.
Yeah. And I got to keep them busy. and you know, this time of year is, of course, you know, they have midterms and, you know, there are all kinds of things going on. And so it gets very busy. But, you know, despite it, you know, I wanted to provide them with really, really good pieces that they can learn a lot from. You know, the difference between, as I explained to them when we first started rehearsing the Beethoven Fourth Symphony, I said, in Tchaikovsky, sometimes, particularly the string players, you cannot hide slight imperfections. In Beethoven, you cannot. And the language is very much more specific. So Beethoven writes a forte or a fortissimo, there has to be differences. If Beethoven writes a dot over a note or an accent mark, it has to be interpreted, and so forth. So you can't really hide in Beethoven. I think that's one of the joys of playing his music.
Mm-hmm. Especially if the rhythm is there and you lock in and all of the playing gets very precise and tight. It's sort of a holdover from that classical style.
That's right. Not to mention, right, that the fact that the notes have become much more important. So now, while like I said, in Tchaikovsky, they can flub this and that. In Beethoven, they may not. So they have to practice all the more diligently in order to achieve the desired results.
Well, I'm sure you were very busy last week in rehearsal or something, but if listeners were tuned in last week, when Andrew Kohler was here to talk about the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, we heard a long saga about Beethoven writing 4 different beginnings to the opera Fidelio.
Yeah.
So the youngsters in the Junior Symphony played Leonora number 3.
Right, that's the famous one.
Well, this one that you're starting with on Sunday would be the, I would call it the real one, because it's the one that prefaces the offer.
That's correct, yeah. So this was the last overture that he wrote because of the revisions that he had to do to Fidelio over the years. It was a very turbulent time, right? The French had invaded Vienna. Beethoven was in his middle heroic period, and he worked very hard on this not so well received opera, Fidelio. But yes, this overture that we're going to play is the one that's played most often at the beginning of the opera. And Leonora 3, oddly, is Act 2. Between scene changes, the conductors usually put it in because it really is the best of the 4 overtures that he wrote.
This one, however, is concise, which is nice. I think it's fascinating to see a composer take the same material and work it and work it until it serves, it's the purpose it's meant to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Leonora is a great concert piece, the Fidelio Overture is really what needed to happen at
That's
the beginning
right.
of the
yeah.
opera.
It's very short. It's about 6 or 7 minutes, and it has all the things required without being like Leonora 3. That's something to listen to. You know, you actually sit and probe. But this one is a little bit more of an appetizer.
Yeah,
kind of thing,
yeah.
You know?
So Leonora is the name of the female character
Correct.
In the
in
opera
Fidelio,
who
yeah.
goes to rescue her
Florestan,
husband.
Yeah, Florestan.
Florestan.
Yeah.
Fidelio must be just the meaning of fidelity, the story of staying true to another person and to a cause.
Correct.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what she assumed, since she dressed up like a guard. So maybe she assumed the name Fidelio. I'm not quite sure in the opera, you know, but
we have to go back to the synopsis, I guess. So let us know what happens here in the in this overture, in the opening, and how does it set the mood?
Mm-hmm. Four bars of the statement of a dotted rhythm theme and an adagio. Four bars of a statement of the allegro theme, and then another adagio, a little bit longer. Finally, we get into the allegro. Adagio comes back at the end for the coda, final coda, and then a very Beethoven heroic period ending coda. So that's that's basically how the piece is constructed, you know, in the very difficult key of E major, which is problematic for intonation for the orchestra, and it's quite bright, as you can imagine, the sound, you know, not like the C minor or E flat major and things like that. So it's quite a bit different.
My guest is Bruce Uchimura. He'll lead this concert on Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium with the University Symphony Orchestra. The concert begins with a Fidelio Overture by Beethoven, and we'll hear a recording now made by the Berlin Philharmonic, led by Claudio Abbado. Well, we heard the Fidelio Overture by Ludwig van Beethoven, and that was a recording, Claudio Abbado. My guest is conductor Bruce Uchimura, who will be leading a program starting with the Fidelio Overture on Sunday. And I'm sure Beethoven would want me to stand up and say I was wrong if I was wrong, or maybe, knowing him, probably not.
I always use that analogy when we're doing a particular composer, either in my cello studio or in the orchestra. I said, if Beethoven was sitting right here and listening to you, what do you think he'd say? And I get the greatest looks on their faces in the world.
Well, he would say, get the time of the concert right.
He might say that.
And the place. So
although,
knowing like
Beethoven,
to correct that.
I think that concerned him less than playing his music effectively, but I don't know.
Well, this will affect listeners who are interested in seeing the concert, which is not at 3.
Yes,
it's
let's get this right.
7:30 p.m. In the Dalton Center Recital Hall. So if you're going anywhere earlier in the day, it might be to see the K. Phil concert, but you can also see this wonderful repertoire, Ravel and Beethoven, played by the University Symphony Orchestra at 7:30 in the Dalton Center.
It is.
And
that's
I'll
correct.
Be sure to repeat that several times.
On Sunday, November 12th.
That's right, this Sunday. Well, we've just taken care of the opening piece, and now we come to Ravel. Which I think of as very precise music also, and especially Here Come the Woodwinds colors. The French just have such an amazing way of hearing woodwinds and blending them in.
They really did elevate the woodwinds, huh? Mm-hmm. To quite the status, you know, they had that in mind, along with a host of other things, primarily Debussy and Ravel, preceded by Fauré a little bit. But, you know, this Impressionist movement really, it's so unique and individual to the French and to music. It's really astounding that we have that repertoire. And, of course, the best examples are with the music of Ravel and Debussy. Particularly in their piano works, oddly enough, but also in their orchestration, particularly with Ravel. Ravel was as good as orchestrator to the French as Rimsky-Korsakov was to the Russians,
That's
I should say.
That's a good analogy. Well, whenever you see the word tombeau, that is an indication that this is a piece in memory or in homage, to in memoriam. And what's unusual is it says Couperin,
mm-hmm.
this composer that lived 200 years before, but it's very much a war story.
That's right. So I don't know why he tacked that on, because everybody asked him about it. And then he would say, well, no, it has nothing to do with Couperin himself, though it was an homage, I believe, in terms of his genre, you know, the style of the Baroque dance suite. So I think that's what he had in mind. But mm-hmm. I don't know why he tacked that Couperin on. And each of the movements, as you know, was dedicated to one of his friends that was lost in World War One,
where he served himself.
He did.
As an ambulance driver, and was certainly affected by that World War One, by the World War One years in France.
Very much so, yeah.
A lot of composers actually did their part in World War One, and some of them lost their lives even. Ravel would go on to live many more years, but this was a particularly creative period, I would say. Once he was able to get back to composing, mm-hmm. We have Tombeau de Couperin, which started off as a keyboard piece.
Yep, yeah. And so the orchestra version is minus the toccata and fugue of the piano version. And the piano, in researching this, I listened to the piano versions as beautiful as the orchestra version.
Yeah.
In some ways, better, because I think that's the way he originally conceived it, you know. And it's such fantastic music in terms of the use of, well, the old forms, but then he puts Ravel's own spin to it, meaning he uses modality and in some cases some real dissonance in the forlorn movement. And yet, you know, in the guise of this old Baroque dance, like the last movement, what is the last movement?
Oh, gosh. I'd have to go right over here to the CD, figure it out. I think we start off with a kind of
Rigadoon, right?
Prelude, Forlan, Menuet, and Rigadoon. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really quite a fascinating piece in the way he uses dance and puts the orchestration along with it.
Well, who's your oboist? I'm curious about that.
Because that's Marcus Jackson, and he's worked very hard. They always work. He told me, are you ready for this? He says, I've been ready for 3 years. He said they practice it constantly, right, because it's one of the big oboe excerpts for orchestra auditions.
Maybe we can share with the audience what we're talking about. It's this oboe figure that starts the piece in the prelude.
Yeah, it reminds me of water.
Okay,
and by the way, the other movements are huge too for the oboe, you know, so it's not just this first movement that's primarily it. Also the clarinet, it's very challenging for all the woodwinds, as you might imagine.
Well, Marcus gets his big moment Sunday at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Listening to Ravel here with Bruce Ujimura.
Wasn't that charming?
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, I have to use the word ornaments, I think, because that also relates to Couperin, who was a keyboard player. And this detail in the melody where it's not just plain da-da-da-da, it's da-da-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum. It's all very decorated.
He also, the orchestration is, it's difficult at first because, you know, the way Ravel orchestrates is very chamber music-like. So it's not, you know, apparent in your part. You have this flurry of 16 notes and then nothing. Mm-hmm. But you don't realize that the 16 notes are traveling through the entire ensemble. Could be, you know, going violin, viola, cello, bass, or it could be going flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon. You know, it depends on the situation. So he really uses it very, very interestingly, and brings in the two horns and trumpet very, very artfully, the way he uses it. Very seductively, and, you know, when you hear it, it's sort of like, you know, it's Ravel, you know, the not just the music, of course, but the orchestration I'm talking about, the timbres that he creates. So he had a very distinctive style that that musicians should be very grateful for.
As you said before, this was based on a piano suite, Le Tombeau de Couperin, which is longer. He chose to orchestrate only four of the movements from this piece.
They've been done, you know, so by other people.
Some people just felt they had to have the complete set.
Yeah, so people have actually arranged them, but they're not nearly as good as these four that Ravel orchestrated himself, mm-hmm. you know.
The University Symphony Orchestra will perform Tombeau de Couperin by Ravel on Sunday at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. And I understand, actually, is this the first time that the orchestra's had the chance to do this since you've been music director?
Good memory, Kara. Yes, this is the first time because it's one of those pieces that's so difficult for the woodwinds. Every time I bring it up, the woodwind faculty look at me going, "You really going to do this?"
Well, it's trial by fire, but beautiful, beautiful, beautiful music.
They're going to do a good job.
Yes. Would you talk a little bit more about the two movements we didn't hear?
The two movements that he did not include in the orchestrated version are the toccata and fugue, two very Baroque forms, not particularly dances in that case. And they're equally interesting when you listen to the piano solo. I wish somebody had orchestrated it, but he probably had his reasons, you know.
It just sounded better to him as
solo
piano. Yeah. Now, the program moves on with a symphony by Beethoven. When you think symphony by Beethoven, you think five. Then you think nine, or maybe nine, then five.
Then or three.
Then you think
right.
three.
Yeah.
Then seven. Poor little four.
Exactly. And I think that's what the symphony is sort of known for. You know, as I was researching, I thought, you know, there's not a lot written about this because it's sandwiched between, of course, the Eroica, which was so dramatically different from anything that anybody had ever heard before. So they were thinking, what's next with Mr. Beethoven? And by the way, he was working on five when he wrote four. But if you know the Beethoven symphonies, it's very, very clear, and I'm sure he was very conscious of this, that the even-numbered symphonies are quite a bit more lighthearted than the odd-number symphonies. So he had that really in mind. Though, I think some of his best writing was in the even-number symphonies. So this one is just, it's a terrific piece. Obviously much more lighthearted. Mm-mm. With tinges, of course, of his middle period, which were heroic, right? The period, just political justice, triumph over oppression, et cetera, et cetera. There's still that, but so interesting. And the music, to me, in my ears, just like three and five, is very memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting dual personality on every other symphony. He was sort of letting out his jolly, humorous self.
He really was.
And
right?
Also maybe working through more of his classical side and his legacy from Haydn being his teacher. And
yeah, I always tease because Beethoven and Mozart both studied with Papa Haydn, right? And Haydn by then was he was a genius, you know, consummate genius, experienced, 80 years old. Mozart adored Haydn, wrote six quartets dedicated to him, some of his best quartets, string quartets. Beethoven hated him.
He rankled under the advice of Haydn.
Although, when you hear particularly his early symphonies, first and second, you know the influence was there. Because even this, with this influence, right, one of the most interesting things about the symphony, right, it's supposed to be the number four in the key of B-flat major. He starts in B-flat minor.
Wow.
With a single B-flat, the orchestra comes in pizzicato, and the woodwinds hold this pedal while the strings come in with this very mysterious sound that you would never expect what's coming up next, you know, when he starts the allegro on that. Second movement, very interesting, part march, part song, you know. kind of variations on this beautiful theme that's very slow. Then the third movement, right by this time, you know, Beethoven got very bored with the minuet and trio form, so it's definitely a scherzo form. The whole scherzo, the A part, is not in three. So it's very confusing for the orchestra to play because nothing's in three, practically. Everything is hemiola in two, as you will hear if we have the time to play that.
Wow.
And the last movement is great. It really does resemble a Haydn, the way Haydn would put together a four-movement symphony, particularly his late symphonies, right, which all start with these big adagios that you don't know what's going to happen.
Does this piece, the symphony number four, use the same number or fewer or more than the Ravel that you will have just performed?
Same number, what?
Of players.
Yeah, that's true. That would be true. I'm using the same number myself. But yes, the Ravel was not intended for a huge Mahler-like symphony orchestra. Neither was the Beethoven.
Neither was Beethoven. Yeah. Another good choice to put them together.
Yeah.
The concert is 7:30 this Sunday. I want to make sure people hear me say that because that's different than the typical University Symphony Concert Time, 7:30. It's a free concert, as always, and it's at the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Let's give the first movement of the Beethoven a listen. That's the opening movement of the Symphony No. 4 of Beethoven. What joyous music. And what a nice way to feel your entire harmonious self tuned to the key of B-flat by the end of the concert. My guest this hour has been Bruce Uchimura. And once again, tell people when and where.
Sunday, November 12th, 7:30 p.m., Dalton Center Recital Hall.
That's a free concert, as always, when the University Symphony Orchestra takes the stage. And this program really focuses on orchestra and orchestral color. We're talking Tombeau de Couperin by Maurice Ravel and then Beethoven's Fourth. And he's starting off with the Fidelio Overture. So I've got to let you head off to rehearsal. And, well, why don't we? You talked about the scherzo of this symphony, saying Beethoven dispensed with what Haydn in 70 symphonies before
Mozart,
it
right.
Had sort of set down as the typical third movement is a 3-4 minuet.
And trio, but Beethoven got very restless with this. And so by this time, the Eroica, actually, he just tossed it out the window. And that was a very rough, gruff for dance scherzo.
Rustic.
And this one is the ultimate scherzo because there's nothing in three in the thing. It's all in two, hemiola. So it's rather confusing, actually, not to the listener particularly, but to the orchestra, because it's very unnatural to see a 3-4 time signature and then play everything in two, you know.
Well, that's why it's a challenge to be a musician, and very fun as well.
Very fun.
Well, enjoy the concert, and see you Sunday.
Thank you, Carol.